Hello and welcome to this week's edition of the Library Cafe, a program of table talk with scholars and librarians about books, ideas, and the formation and circulation of knowledge. I'm Thomas Hill. Today I am very pleased to be talking with the cognitive scientist Jamshed Barucha about the subject of his research, the biopsychology of music. Mr. Barucha is also provost and a senior vice president of Tufts University, a former Vassar College trustee, and he is also a recipient of the AAVC Award for Distinguished Achievement. Welcome back to Vassar.
Thank you. Delight to be here.
It must be an exciting time to be working in biopsychology, since important discoveries about the way our minds work appear in the news on what seems to be a monthly, if not a weekly, basis. And I expect this has to do in part with the tools that have been recently adapted for research in this area, especially MRI.
Yep, that's right. That's right.
And just as a matter of curiosity, I've undergone MRI myself.
Okay.
And what I remember about it is that it's insanely noisy. And it's like being rolled into a steel tube with a room full of chimpanzees with ball-peen hammers pounding on the outside. So how does one listen to music in one of these?
Well, MRI machines are noisy. They are getting quieter.
Mm-hmm.
And that's good news. But certainly when I began to do this research with the first generation of MRI machines, they were very clanky. And the trick then was to build into the experiment a control condition. And so you'd play music for the participant who's in their MRI machine. And then you record from the brain. And then you'd also go through equivalent periods where there's no music.
Mm-hmm.
And the machine continues to make noise. And so both the music and the no music segments have the machine noise, and so you can factor out the machine noise.
Oh, I see. And the MRI essentially allows us to measure activity in the human brain in real time?
It does. It's not exactly real time. It's a bit sluggish, mm-hmm. because what the functional MRI does is measure blood flow. Mm-hmm. When a part of your brain is extremely active, it sends signals for more oxygenated blood. And so the oxygenated blood starts to rush to those centers, and about 4 seconds later reaches those centers in its peak. And so when you measure a functional MRI signal, you have to infer back 4 seconds or so to when the actual activity took place in the brain.
Uh-huh. Do you work exclusively with MRI, or do you use other methods also?
I use other methods. I mean, I should say, you know, I am a senior administrator, and so I have a full-time administrative job at a decently sized university with a lot of schools. But it is important to me to continue to be involved, at least to some extent, in research, because I think that keeps me intellectually alive. MRI is just one of many techniques available. I was actually, for most of my career, considered myself a cognitive psychologist,
mm-hmm.
and the methods that are used by cognitive psychologists and were used before MRI didn't directly measure brain activity. They indirectly inferred theories about how the mind works,
mm-hmm.
from other kinds of measures, such as the kinds of errors that people make, or the reaction time to process different kinds of information.
Yeah, there's studies that have been done for a long time on people with damaged brains that continue.
Sure, absolutely, yes, those studies as well.
Yeah. Is the study of music perception in biopsychology a relatively new field?
It's relatively new, but some of us have been working in the trenches for a while.
Uh-huh.
What's gratifying to see in the last few years is that the public interest has increased dramatically.
Uh-huh.
I remember for most of my years doing research, combining music with psychology, a lot of my colleagues in psychology would sort of squint their eyes and say, why music? Why are you studying me? What does that have to do with the mind? Well, of course, it has everything to do with it. And now with this new interest in neuroscience and mm-hmm. how the brain works, people seem to immediately recognize the linkage that, in fact, we would not be able to perceive music if it weren't for our brains. And so there's something going on in the brain.
I noticed there are two books out just in the last 6 months or year anyway.
Absolutely.
And one by Oliver Sacks, an interesting book of
case histories.
That's
right.
New areas of discovery like this can be quite fractious with regard to how findings are interpreted, I know. And is that the case with your field?
There is some fractiousness about a few points of detail, but not a huge amount.
No,
I think clearly the field is in its early stages.
Uh-huh.
neuroscience in general, I think, is in its early stages. Even though there's a lot that we have learned, we are really just scratching the surface, you know, to speak figuratively, of the brain. And the next few decades are going to, I think, produce just an avalanche of new information. So, yeah, there is some fractiousness about some disagreements about this or that, but by and large, agreement, I think, on most things.
Uh-huh. So what does your research tell us about what happens to us when we listen to music?
Well, one of the things I've always been interested in is the relationship between the brain and culture. Historically, in the academy, people have distinguished between biological or brain-based explanations on the one hand and cultural explanations on the other. And that's always bothered me because, in fact, the brain is, I like to call it, an organ of culture. It is the organ of culture. We don't carry our culture around in our hearts or our livers or our stomachs. Mm-hmm. We carry our culture around with us in our brains. And when we're in another community, another geographical or cultural community, we bring to it all of the exposure that we've had to our own culture, which is encoded in our brains. And so I've always wanted to study the extent to which and the way in which the brain absorbs culture and encodes it, if you like, in the brain. And so some colleagues and I have done some studies on that, which are ongoing, to try and demonstrate that people who've been exposed to different kinds of music end up responding differently to the same kind of music only because their brains have adapted to these different structures from different musical cultures.
Mm-hmm. Is there a way, when you're looking at these effects on the brain, to distinguish where auditory structures of music stop and purely cognitive representations begin, or do they blend into one another?
They blend into one another. I think that as of even a few years ago, people would have liked to have thought that the division of labor in the brain is very clear. The brain is modular in the sense that, yes, different parts of the brain take on specialized responsibility for different kinds of processing. So there are parts of the brain that are involved in visual perception, parts involved in auditory perception, parts involved in memory, and so on. But with the exception of some areas that are extremely specialized, there are many areas that seem to have multiple functions. So for example, when you listen to music, yes, you see the auditory areas of the cortex, the auditory cortex, for example, involved, but you also see prefrontal cortex, which is implicated in lots and lots of things, many things that involve distinctly human capacities. You see activation of the cerebellum of the brain, which is involved in timing and other sorts of things. You see activation of the motor cortex of the brain just by listening to music.
I noticed you have a background in philosophy as well as science, and also you're a musician. And I wonder, does this influence your interest in culture, particularly in the way it...
It certainly does. I think that my teaching and research in cognitive neuroscience and cognitive psychology has influenced me beyond the research itself. Obviously, it influences my teaching. The research influences the teaching, but it also, I think, has influenced the way in which I think about the world, and in which I think about life, and it certainly has influenced the way in which I approach music as an amateur chamber music player.
It does, in terms of the playing of music or in terms of practice?
Certainly how one practices. The standard pedagogies for music performance, I think, need revision in light of some of the things that we know from the study of memory and the study of performance and how the brain learns. And I've written a little bit about this. And so I remember having teachers that wanted you to figure out which are the difficult passages in a piece and then play each one 10 times before going on to the next one. And yes, the more times you play a passage, the better you learn it. But the research really suggests that you shouldn't be just playing one passage 10 times and then another one 10 times and a third one 10 times. Play them all 10 times, but mix them up. That's counterintuitive because you don't notice the improvement while you're practicing as much, but it better predicts performance later on. So that's just one example. There are many, many examples I can think of where the way I approach music has been informed by what I've learned in the study of psychology and neuroscience.
Mm-hmm. And then the usual structure then of academic teaching with an emphasis on lectures and then seminars later on, are these structures, do you think, in need of change?
Well, I think that now we're getting far afield from music, which is fine because I'm also interested in education and bringing to bear knowledge from cognitive science and brain science to education. And what I realize is that the way we organize education in society has more to do with our feeling well-organized about it than it does to do with learning. And, of course, we can't turn society completely on its head, so we can't we can't change everything completely, but we tend to package education a bit too much. We package it into degrees and courses and sections within courses, and the mark of a good syllabus is that it's very well organized. You feel organized. The students feel it's well organized. But unfortunately for us, that turns out not necessarily to be the best way to go about it. For the same reasons that I cited with practice, it turns out that if you mix things up more, you're more likely to retrieve what you've learned later on when you need to retrieve it.
There's a
principle in cognitive psychology called context specificity, which translates as follows. Learning occurs in the very specific contexts in which you are learning. And so when you learn a principle or a fact, you learn it in very specific contexts. Mm-hmm. And it's not easy for the brain to generalize or translate it into other contexts when needed. It's also not easy to even recall what you've learned later on if you're not in the same context. Mm-hmm. Because two things. One is we forget, and to recall, you really need to duplicate or resemble the context in which you learned. And so the solution to that is to learn in multiple contexts, diverse contexts, not only context in terms of the subject matter, but context in time, over different points in time. Mm-hmm. That maximizes the chance that later on, when you actually have to retrieve some of what you have learned, that you will be able to do so. Because the retrieval context is more likely to match one of the learning contexts.
Yeah, that's interesting. It argues for interdisciplinary study, certainly, then.
It certainly does. And that, you know, Vassar, of course, has been on the forefront of interdisciplinary teaching for a long time, and I certainly owe my interdisciplinary orientation to the time I was at Vassar, where I was so taken by the possibility that you could do all these different things that I think I took 150% advantage of it, and lots of courses in biology and psychology and philosophy and in music, and haven't wanted to really ever stop. So yes, interdisciplinarity is good from that point. Now, it's important when you talk about interdisciplinarity that you don't weaken the disciplinary rigor that's been developed in a number of disciplines. Yeah. And I think the real trick for us as educators is to figure out how to promote interdisciplinary teaching and scholarship without losing the benefit of the rigorous platforms and methodologies that have been developed by the disciplines.
Focus, yeah, it's very interesting. Speaking of memory and music generally, certainly it's much easier to remember a string of words if they're set to music. And I can remember myself most of the lyrics of most of the songs that ever made it into the top 40 between 1960 and 1970 if I hear even just a small passage of the original tune. And this is something I accomplished wholly unconsciously because I never actually tried to remember these lyrics. Some of them I don't want to remember, but, you know. So how is music perception related to memory function?
Of course, everything that we learn is encoded in memory in some way. And so in psychology, memory doesn't just refer to the things that we think of having memorized. It refers to all knowledge, everything that we know, really, or know how to do. And most of what we know how to do, we don't actually have conscious access to. It's called implicit knowledge. That's another thing that we need to rethink in education. Education, it tends to be focused on explicit knowledge, the stuff we can describe using language. Mm-hmm. And that's really just the tip of the iceberg in terms of knowledge and in terms of what we can do cognitively as well. With music, You say that you can remember tunes, you can remember lyrics, even though you didn't consciously focus on them at the time. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. A lot of learning occurs automatically without effort and gets encoded in there quite robustly in most cases. And that kind of learning tends to constitute what we call implicit knowledge. We don't take that as seriously in education as we should.
Do we know to what extent the capacity for acquiring musical capability is genetic, and to what extent it's a matter of learning and environment?
Well, some people are born more musical mm-hmm. than others, and I think that the nature-nurture question really is answered by saying both are involved. There is clearly learning involved. You can't develop musical expertise, or you can't become a good performer, or you can't become an experienced listener without, in fact, having significant experience and engagement with music. There's no such thing as somebody who just sort of pops out of the womb and is suddenly a genius. Yeah. Okay, that's a bit of a myth. There are a lot of these genius myths. There are no examples of people who have attained significant proficiency with music without significant training. Mm-hmm. Having said, so yes, the nurture side of it is necessary, but there are also differences innately between individuals. Mm-hmm. That's just patently the case. Some people respond more easily to learning situations than others do.
Yeah. Is there a biological basis at all for the idea of perfect pitch? Does the research show anything either way?
Yeah. Well, first of all, perfect pitch is, there's a lot of mystique surrounding perfect pitch. All of our brains respond to the absolute frequencies present in sound. Uh-huh. And so to some extent, we all have perfect, or what is better called, absolute pitch.
That's very interesting from a philosophical point of view, because it's an argument for the idea of universals of some kind in the brain.
Sure. Well, there are a number of universals. Mm-hmm. I think that relative pitch is, or being able to recognize pitch relative to some reference, mm-hmm. is built upon absolute pitch. So I think the question gets misframed. Typically, people wonder, how come some people have absolute or perfect pitch and most people don't? The real question, I think, is, well, assuming that we all do to some extent, and I'll explain that in a minute, mm-hmm. how is it that we also have relative pitch over and above that? We know that we all have absolute pitch to some extent because you couldn't use language. Vowels are determined by the absolute frequencies of the resonances in the vowels of speech. And so if you speed up a tape of speech, it's not just faster, but you actually change the nature of the vowels. And so we all have absolute pitch, but not in the sense of pressing a key on the piano and being able to say what it is. Some people, again, are more predisposed to it than others. And there are some reports that certain parts of the brain are more prominent in people who have absolute pitch. Yeah. The planum temporale on the left side, it's a structure in the brain, is implicated in absolute pitch.
Mm-hmm. Then what about tone deafness? Same argument, I suppose, then.
It's a similar argument. Again, I think there is a lot of mythology surrounding tone deafness, and a lot of people who are characterized as being tone deaf, and many do characterize themselves as being tone deaf, in fact, can make lots and lots of auditory distinctions.
Mm-hmm. Is there any scientific support for expectant parents who play music to their prenatal children who expect this will affect developmental learning later on? And is there anything special about Mozart?
Yeah, the Mozart effect really caught the public attention about 10 years ago. Yeah. It was based on an article published in 95 or 96 in a journal called Nature. And it reported a study in which people listened to music to Mozart for 10 minutes and then took a spatial IQ test. Mm-hmm. And in a control condition, they sat in silence for 10 minutes and then took the IQ test. And those who had just heard Mozart for 10 minutes did better on the spatial IQ test. Well, this went straight to the front pages of newspapers and talk shows and so on and so forth. And the result got morphed to the claim that if you listen to music, you know, to Mozart as a baby or even prenatally, mm-hmm. you're going to grow up to be more likely to get into Vassar. Well, those experiments, those results were being reported even before those studies were done. There still has not been a study that has tracked infants listening to Mozart mm-hmm. or not listening to Mozart to see whether they grow up to be smarter or less smart. Some of those studies are underway, mm-hmm. but by their very nature, they take time. So we don't know the answer. It's unlikely, I think, given the evidence out there, that there's something unique to Mozart.
Mm-hmm.
I say this as a person who loves Mozart, and I play Mozart string quartets, but I just don't think that the scientific evidence suggests yes. that there are effects that are unique to Mozart. There are a number of effects that might be more general, however.
Mm-hmm.
This initial effect that increases spatial IQ can be produced by other kinds of music. It can also be produced by other kinds of stimuli that are not musical. So, for example, reading stories to people, turns out, increases their performance on these spatial IQ tests. So there's something about the stimulation,
mm-hmm.
about maybe the mood manipulation, maybe the complexity that puts the brain in a position to perform in some way. And as for the effect of music on your later life, there's no question that early exposure to music affects your ability to perceive and perform and engage in music later on. What we don't know well enough yet is whether early exposure to music influences other non-musical things like math or spatial.
Well, there are these anecdotes, say, about Einstein, who attributed his intelligence to having learned to play the violin when he was a child, and his biographer reported that when he would become stuck on a problem, he would play his violin and he would work his way through.
Yeah, those are very provocative statements that I think it'll be a while before we can fully understand really what's going on in those cases.
Yeah. Are there consistent stimulus effect patterns, especially with autonomic systems like heart rate and blood pressure, when you listen to certain kinds of music?
Oh, sure. Yeah. There's no question that music can affect our moods and our emotions. It doesn't do so in as reliable a fashion as some would like, because music is so contextual.
Yeah.
There are some aspects of music that universally are correlated with certain kinds of emotions. So, for example, nowhere in the world would you find something that's intended to be sad played really, really fast. But other than some of those correlations, the emotional communicative capacity of music can be very context-specific and culturally specific.
What about the relation of music to speech? Is there anything that the kind of research that you do can tell us about human speech and language?
The relationship between music and speech is now one of the most interesting topics of research, and we've been doing some of that as well. It appears to be the case. I'd say there's a consensus that speech and music share neural circuits.
Mm-hmm.
They share functional properties in several domains, in the domain of pitch, so pitch patterns, mm-hmm. going up, coming down, for example, and in the domain of rhythm and timing. Speech has a rhythm to it. Mm-hmm. Linguists study music has a rhythm to it. And it's no coincidence that the temporal ranges within which we perceive timing units or rhythmic units are pretty much the same in speech and music. If I hit a beat now and then come back 24 hours later and hit it again, and then 24 hours later hit it again, you won't hear it as a beat.
Yeah.
Okay. But you hear this as a beat. And if it goes too fast, you won't hear it as a beat. So there's a very narrow window of time within which repeated pulses are perceived as a beat. And that's the case with speech as well. So some would say music adapted some cognitive capacities that evolved in the brain for language. I would say it's almost certainly the other way around, that long before language existed, language is a fairly recent innovation in evolution, language as we know it, that is to say with syntax, the use of noun phrases and verb phrases and so on and so forth, is one of the most recent innovations in brain function. Prior to that, certainly there were vocal forms of communication, non-syntactic vocal forms of communication, such as you find in mammals, in whales, and in all kinds of mammals, who use sound patterns, who use pitch, who use rhythm in pitch to communicate emotion and intention, group identification, individual identification, courtship, a whole range of things. Yeah. And so I think that language has picked up on some of those things.
Sometimes on our show, especially when we have time after an interview, I raid the Smithsonian Global Sound for Libraries collection, which has a lot of ethnographic music that has been recorded by the Smithsonian over the years. And recently we played music from a hunting and gathering tribe, I think it was in Borneo, it may have been northern New Guinea, in which a woman would sing a few short refrains, really just a sentence, into the jungle at dusk from the edge of a clearing where her village was, to let the other women who were in the jungle gathering know that night was falling, because night fell so quickly as the sun dropped behind a mountain that they wouldn't be able to get out of the jungle if someone didn't warn them. And the lyrics went something like, "Sister, sister, I miss you, come home." And it occurred to me when I was listening to this that this isn't something she could have shouted. It wouldn't have carried in the same way. And it just seemed to me an instance of something of what you were just saying, that there was still a relic there, I think, in the way music was being used to communicate.
Oh, sure.
Thinking about environment and evolution, what about the role of music in the transmission of cultural memory? Is that part of this? We just had a show recently on oral traditions and the way cultural memory is communicated orally with music, basically.
Yeah, that's a great point. Music clearly played a role in the oral transmission of knowledge before we had writing.
Yeah.
And even after we had writing. I mean, writing was the privileged purview, writing and reading, of a very small number of people until just a few centuries ago. But writing itself is only 4,000 years old. And before that, knowledge was transmitted orally.
Yeah.
And the oral tradition relied on poetic structure as well as musical structures. And so rhyme, rhythm, for example, are some poetic structures. And then musically, pitch, phrasing, timing, rhythm, were ways in which you could recall and transmit from generation to generation language-based information. Mm-hmm. So people would remember the lyrics by remembering the tune.
And what about bonding? And I'm thinking of the lullaby as a kind of music. And of course, babies sing to some extent, even as they're just learning to talk.
Absolutely. Music fosters social cohesion. Mm-hmm. That's probably one of its most important evolutionary bases. Mm-hmm. And it does so in many ways. I mentioned already using song, as birds do, for species identification, individual identification, and courtship. Mm-hmm. But it was clearly used in a tribal way, going back hundreds of thousands, if not millions of years, to promote cohesion within groups who all recognized the same songs and the dances. And it served to synchronize the behaviors of groups. And so this is something that I've been writing about recently, is the synchronization, social synchronization that's brought about by music and dance that gets a group of people moving together, doing something together, having the same kinds of experiences and being in the same mental state, enables you to define groups where the group is more than the sum of the individuals.
Yeah, that's interesting. A lot of the folk music actually in the Smithsonian series has to do with grinding corn or hollowing out canoes or paddling canoes, and it is just that.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, so.
And you mentioned animals. Are any of the studies that you do done on animals so that comparisons can be made about the way a bird, say, hears bird music or some other kind of auditory signal and the way the human mind...
There is a lot of research on bird song, which is very interesting, and there's also increasing amounts of research on whale song and dolphins and vocalizations of other species. What has not been found in those studies is evidence for what we call generativity. Generativity is a term that comes from linguistics to describe a property of human language such that with a small number of building blocks, words, parts of speech, you can generate an infinite number of sentences. And so the last sentence that you uttered, and certainly the last sentence that I uttered, you or I have never uttered ever before in our lives, I can assure you of that. Every day, we're producing completely novel sentences that we have never heard before, and yet we make ourselves clear. And so that's called generativity. The parallel question for music is there evidence of generativity in the vocalizations of animals, such as we have for music? Musicians, using a small set of building blocks, the notes of the scale, produce an infinite number of songs. We have not found that in animals. Now, were we to find it, I wouldn't be surprised. I'd be very delighted, because we just may not have the ability to detect it yet in animals. But thus far, we have not been able to see it.
Yeah, the catbird that sits on my roof sometimes I think is making a crack at it, you know.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, with the singing the songs of other birds, essentially, large numbers. It might be actually a mockingbird. It might not be a catbird. But
well, yeah, I mean,
that's quite different, I know.
Mockingbird, I mean, the ability to copy is an important evolutionary development, but it's different from generativity.
Yeah.
It's different from a bird just coming up with a totally new song and having the other birds understand it.
Yeah. It's interesting that I've noticed myself, cats can be calmed by music made by humans. I don't know if, you know, that kind of thing can be studied. I can't imagine you getting a cat into an MRI tube to be still, but...
Well, someday we will. It's a bit too expensive at the moment.
What happens when I remember a certain piece of music in my head where no actual music is being perceived? Do the same neurons fire?
Yes. Some of the same circuits in the brain that are involved in perception of music are also involved in musical imagery when you just have music going through your head.
And music is sometimes referred to as a kind of spatialized time. And you talked about time and the way a beat can be perceived if beats are close together. And in scholastic psychology, music is defined as the continuous in motion. And I wonder, can research into music perception tell us anything about the way our brains comprehend time, which is another great philosophical conundrum?
It is a conundrum. I mean, it's a very interesting question. I don't pretend to have the answers about that. Clearly, music occurs in time. Music structures time. And there's much that we can learn about time from the study of music and vice versa. And there are some attempts at it, but I think... by and large, we know very little about time.
Yeah. And what about consciousness, another, you know, one of those philosophical terms that comes into play here? Does your work in biopsychology have to make certain philosophical assumptions, or do you accept what is sometimes called in psychology the theory of core consciousness or the core self?
Well, consciousness is finally has become an accepted topic within cognitive science and cognitive neuroscience and academic psychology. It had been avoided for a long time because I think that we just didn't feel that there were the tools to study it in ways that were reproducible. I think that we're still far, far, far away from having an understanding of what's going on. And as you know, there are many philosophers who don't even think the questions are framed correctly. Some would say what we call consciousness is sort of a story that we tell ourselves about an experience that we have rather than actual experience that we have. And I think it's within philosophy, consciousness, the term, runs into a lot of trouble. Although for the average person, it seems sort of obvious what the distinction is between conscious and unconscious.
If what happens in the mind when you listen to a piece of music is that there is this oscillation between familiarity and expectation on the one hand and novelty on the other, it seems if we're going to think about consciousness, that's one point where, you know, it might be in play.
Well, clearly, one of the features of aesthetics and music specifically is this toying with expectations. Mm-hmm. A composer is toying with your expectations by generating expectations for tones or chords or beats that might follow, based on what typically occurs, and then violating them to varying degrees. And some people have a preference for lots of violation, some people for only subtle violation. And those violations are arousing. They actually introduce sort of energy into the physiological system and attract attention, or anything that's a surprise or a violation of expectation attracts attention. And with attention comes consciousness, because often, I mean, some would say, consciousness is attention. Whatever it is that we're attending to, we are conscious of, and vice versa.
What do you make of the way consciousness frames musical experience and certainly musical pleasure, that we seek out not so much real experience but virtual experience, or that we can take pleasure, for instance, in something that's sad in music?
Well, the last question is something that people have thought about. Why would you want to listen to a sad piece of music? Mm-hmm. Why would you want, for that matter, to go to a horror movie? Or to read a tragedy play that's a tragedy. And a lot of people, when they reject certain kinds of music, say, you know, it's not pleasant to the ear. They use expressions like that. And I always say back to them, well, why should it be pleasant to the ear? You know, have you ever been to a movie that was a horror film? Yeah. Or have you ever read a novel that's a tragedy? Those are clearly not pleasant. And yet they're great art. And in fact, people tend to be drawn to them. So a lot of people have thought about this issue. Why in real life, if we would not be drawn to tragedy, if we would not be drawn to sadness, those are things we want to get away from, why would we be drawn to them in art? And the best, I don't think we have a good handle on that dilemma. I'd say the best angle we have on it is that you use the word virtual. I think that when we are in a movie or reading a novel or listening to a piece of music and we feel certain emotions, our brains are also cognizant of the fact that this is not actually happening to us. And so is able to keep track of the emotion detached from any consequence that might befall us. Mm-hmm. And therefore, we can actually enjoy, if you like, experiencing negative emotions vicariously with no consequence. Yeah. If somebody dies in a novel, it really there's very little consequence to your life. And so you can indulge in that experience.
Yeah. And it enters into a kind of performative grouping of experiences where you can imagine what might happen if such and such were to occur and then and then feel pleasure that you can think your way past
absolutely.
It,
right? It enables you to simulate life. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Why is music pleasurable in biological terms? Does it stimulate pleasure centers in the brain?
There are some evidence of reward centers being involved, but there are lots of other centers involved as well.
Yeah. And when you use music in your research, does it matter what kind of music you use? Do you use classical music? Do you use popular music, rap music?
Most of the research for one reason or another has involved Western classical music, and I'm guilty of the same. Although I have done cross-cultural research using Indian classical music, and more recently in the work that I'm doing on the brain and culture have been using popular forms of music, both Western and Eastern.
So we've been talking mostly about what happens when we listen to music, when we translate auditory codes into consciousness or what have you. What happens in the brain when we do the reverse, when we play an instrument or sing, especially in the case of a jazz artist who is composing something from memory?
You're right that disproportionately the research has been on perception. Mm-hmm. I think that's only because it's been easier to do.
Yeah.
Scientists tend to simplify things, and I don't think it's intended to suggest that they believe things are that simple. It's just that you tackle problems that are tractable, and I think performance and composition are harder problems. There are people who are doing very good work on those topics. Performance research now has been greatly enhanced by a lot of technology, lasers and that can be used to digitally track movement, the body movement as you perform. And so there's some terrific work going on there on performance. As you can imagine, a skilled performer isn't necessarily conscious of everything that he or she is doing.
Uh-huh.
That's the nature of a skill. And so you actually do have to study the performer to find out what it is that the performer is doing objectively to communicate and what objective patterns of behavior in terms of timing of the movement and the kind of movement that occurs, what parameters are being used by the performer unconsciously in order to capture their communicative intent. On composition, there is a fair amount that's been written about that. Composition really brings to bear a whole host of different cognitive capacities. Mm-hmm. Many of them are analytical. Many have to do with notation.
Yeah.
Many have to do with musical imagery. Many have to do with perception. And many are just strategic, deciding I'm going to put repeats here and so on and so forth. But composition is a form of creativity that is generative. I mean, one of the features of creativity in humans is that it is generative in the sense that I mentioned earlier, that with a set of building blocks and a skill in how they are combined, you can then start to spin off completely new combinations of these building blocks. You can start to push the boundaries of the way they're combined. You can start to build new building blocks. And that's really how creativity takes off. So composition, improvisation are like that. People sometimes think about improvisation, how did somebody just come up with that from nowhere?
Mm-hmm.
Well, nobody comes up with anything from nowhere, okay? Any improvisation draws upon past experience.
Yeah, memory, yes.
Yeah. A memory, usually building blocks that the performer, the improviser, has worked with before, has experimented with, combining in different ways. And through experimentation, through practice, through pushing the bounds, through honing the skills of how you combine these building blocks, some people get really good at it and get to the point where they can literally spin off new combinations that constitute improvisation or creative performance.
Interesting. That's how oral poets seem to seem to work also in a kind of performative environment. Huh? So a last question. I wonder, do you have any grand idea of what the promise of biocognitive research in general is? I mean, it is an exciting field, and in the sciences and technology generally, whenever you hear anyone talking about their work, they talk about it in messianic terms. I think that's, to some extent, an American cultural thing, that everything seems an absolute revolution is going to sweep everything away that we have from the past. But this does seem to be an exciting area, especially with the biofeedback aspect of it. And do you have...
You talk about biopsychology in general, associated with music.
Both the biopsychology of music, but biopsychology in general.
Oh, absolutely. Within the sciences, I think there are two relatively young frontiers that have unlimited horizons. Okay, one is neuroscience and one is genetics. And we haven't even seen how those two are going to interact. I think one of the most explosive new fields is going to be the interaction of those two, how genetics influences the development of the brain through learning. So in other words, how genetic and environmental factors combine to drive the development of the brain and the interaction between brains and their environments. And I think we are really just at the very beginning. We are going to, in our lifetimes, see huge, massive steps forward. Look, the brain has a level of complexity that we really still are not able to get our arms around. And we have learned a lot about the existence of neurons and how they connect and synapses, and that learning probably involves changing the strengths of synapses between neurons. We've learned a lot about the biochemistry of the brain and the neurotransmitters that transmit signals from one neuron to the next. We've learned a lot about how emotional regulation involves the nervous system as well as the biochemistry of the body. But, boy, that is just tiny, 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 tiny. How I'm able to say what I'm saying right now and you're able to understand it, it's a long ways away. So I would say stay tuned. The stuff is just going to be exploding.
Yeah, it's fascinating. So I'd like to thank you, Jamshed, for visiting with us on the Library Cafe today to talk about the biopsychology of music.
Thank you, Tom. It's been a pleasure, and this is a terrific program, and it's a really delight for me to be back at Vassar, where I really got started on my intellectual journey many, many years ago.
Well, thanks a lot, and it's been fun.